It's a real treat to be back here, and I'm very honored to have been invited back after my talk last time. It's interesting talking about presidents in the on President's Day weekend and in the light of the presidential campaigns, at least the nomination campaigns going on now. And the other day when I was in the supermarket and I noticed that the National Enquirer was had some headlines about John Kerry, and I realized, I guess this is serious if they're starting to attack him already. And one of the things it said was that he had plastic surgery, you know, done for him. Well, you know, I thought, God, who is this plastic surgeon anyway? And then this morning, I was listening to the radio, and there were different stories about the presidents, and this one was about Lincoln. I thought, oh, how appropriate. And it seems that in his career, he was accused of being two-faced, and he said, if I had two faces, why would I show this one? So, anyway, Lincoln did have quite a good sense of humor, although I really won't be dwelling on that today. What I'm going to talk about today is how so much of what we take for granted as the American dream was really, in some ways, created by, or certainly articulated by, Lincoln. And I'm not going to talk too long because last time I almost wrecked it by not having time for a talk back. So I'm going to cover quite a lot in a fairly limited time. Those of you who remember anything about my talk round about last July 4th, it was about the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson. And at that time, I mentioned that Jefferson had really borrowed a lot of the ideas of John Locke and changed a little bit. And Locke, in his writings, talked about the right of life, liberty, and property. And then in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson changed that to the right that we all have to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And after my talk, I chatted with various people, including Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said, you know where the term happiness comes from, what it actually means. And I said, no. And she said, well, it means luck or fortune. And so that kind of interested me, and I looked into it a little further and discovered it comes from the old English word of hap. So happiness comes from that. Hapless, someone who doesn't have any luck. Happenstance, the way our fortunes play out, and so on. And that made me think about Lincoln, because I think one of the contributions that Lincoln made, and by the way, I think this is one of the many reasons why he is, I think most would agree, our greatest president, certainly in my opinion he is that he was able to reinterpret our history in a significant way that touched what was really going on in our country and in the minds of our people. And we still use that. We still borrow from Lincoln's interpretations of our past. So what I'm going to suggest today is that Lincoln gave definition to what this happiness is supposed to be. Because another way of stating what's in the Declaration of Independence would be we all have the unalienable right of life, liberty, and the opportunity to try our luck. And I think Lincoln gave definition to what this idea of try our luck really means. And in essence, what it means is that we all should have the opportunity to advance ourselves, that we all should have the opportunity to rise up in the social and economic ladder. So that's my overall point, and I'm going to look at different phases of his writings and speeches to show how this came into play. So the idea of advancement for Lincoln meant various things, and one of them was that he could leave his past behind. He was a man who came from a poor background. He had very little respect for his father. I don't know whether that was warranted, but that was the case. And he also feared that his mother was illegitimate. And so as a young man, he was able to make his own way. By the way, it's interesting to note that Lincoln was born in Kentucky, just about 5 miles away from where Jefferson Davis was born, and how Lincoln tried his luck in the what was known as the Old Northwest, Illinois, and Jefferson Davis went to the Southwest, what was then the Southwest, Mississippi. Anyway, Lincoln took a lot of pride in his accomplishments, and as we all know, he did physical labor. He split rails. He was a very strong, sturdy, big man. And he also improved his mind and eventually became a lawyer and was a very, very successful lawyer, worked on a lot of cases having to do with the railroads coming into Illinois, and made, by the time he got into the 1840s, made about $5,000 a year, which was a considerable amount of money. And when he was assassinated, he left behind an estate of about $85,000. So although he started off very poor, he was extremely successful. And one of the things that was important to him was that he could shed this, what he took to be very unpromising beginning with a very unpromising family. And of course he did marry up too. Mary Todd was from a much more prominent family than Lincoln was. And Lincoln did not invite his father to his wedding. He did not attend his father's funeral. So one thing that I get out of all this was that he wanted to reinvent himself and not be poor white trash, so to speak, but to be Mr. Lincoln, someone of importance and someone whose ambitions were realized. And I think that one of the things about Lincoln that I admire so much was his ability to draw on his own experiences and then transfer that to other people. And so, for instance, in the 1850s, there was a party known as the Know Nothing Party that came into prominence. And their major idea was that they were wanting to protect the United States by making sure that there were very few immigrants who came and that those who did come had to wait a very long time before they could become citizens and really participate in public life. And this disturbed Lincoln, and I think one of the reasons it disturbed him was because he himself had reinvented himself, and he believed, therefore, that other people should have that opportunity too, and that you shouldn't be held back because you were from some non-English ethnic group. And he writes to his friend Joshua Speed in 1855. He says, "As a nation, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. When the know-nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. To Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure without the base alloy of hypocrisy." So I will be reading a little bit from various of Lincoln's writings because, you know, how can you do anything better than that? I mean, among other things, he was, I think, one of our best writers. Another thing that I wanted to share with you was his ideas, which he just briefly touched on here, about the Declaration of Independence and how that should open up the door to all people, whatever their ethnic background was. And in his reply to Douglas during the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, July 10th, so it's right after the July 4th holidays, he says that Mr. Douglas, my opponent, says that the Declaration only applies to people who are of English descent. But I disagree. And he says, when we look at this holiday and we see all the great things that our forebears did and this great declaration that they made, that's all well and good for those of us who can trace our ancestry to them. But what about all those people, those German people, Irish people, Swedish people, French people, Scandinavian people, and so on, of whom there were quite a lot at this time in Illinois? What connection do they have to all of this? And so let me read to you what he says. It's true they're not blood of blood, but when they look through that old Declaration of Independence, they find that those old men said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And then they feel that moral sentiment taught in that day evidences their relation to those men, that it is the father of all moral principle in them, and that they have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the flesh of the men who wrote that declaration. And so they are. That is the electric cord in that declaration that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together, that will link those patriotic hearts as long as the love of freedom exists in the minds of men throughout the world. So that is one area with this whole thing of immigration and reinventing yourself and being free to do that. Now, the next area that I want to talk about is labor. And it's very interesting. Again, it's a sort of a way of projecting Lincoln's own personal experiences as a manual laborer to those of other people, and the fact that he was able to get ahead from being a manual laborer to being a successful lawyer, and thinking this should be the case with other people who are ambitious enough and choose to do this. And I'm going to read to you an excerpt from by the way, as you read through Lincoln, he's very long-winded. Very, very long-winded. Although it all ties together, it really, but you know, he would just never make it today with these 30-second sound bites, so forget it. But anyway, the first part of this was given in 1859 to the Wisconsin State Agricultural Society. And it's interesting because Karl Marx's Das Kapital, the first volume of that, was not published until 1867. So this is 8 years before Das Kapital, and he says, he doesn't say this is his idea, but obviously it is his idea. So he's talking about the people who support free labor, meaning people who can labor freely and not be slaves. He talks about free labor. He says, they hold that labor is prior to and independent of capital. That in fact, capital is the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. That labor can exist without capital, but that capital could never have existence without labor. Hence, they, and he himself, hold that labor is the superior, greatly the superior, of capital. And then he goes on to talk about really his own experiences. But again, he projects this onto his audience. He says, many independent men in this assembly, doubtless a few years ago, were hired laborers. And their case is almost, if not quite, the general rule. The prudent, penniless beginner in the world labors for wages a while, saves a surplus with which to buy tools or land for himself, then labors on his own account another while, and at length hires another beginner to help him. This is free labor, the just, generous, and prosperous system which opens the way for all, gives hope to all, and energy and progress and improvement of condition to all. So this was Lincoln's life, and he thought this should be the life of opportunity for other people, not that they would be frozen in a particular class as hirelings or a particular class as capitalists, but that there would be a progress available to all. And one of the things that he believed really very early in his life was that Negroes, a term that he used, should have that same opportunity. And I'm going to read to you from a speech that he gave in the Lincoln-Douglas debates in July, a week after the other one I just read. This was at Springfield. The other one was in Chicago. And he says, "I do not understand the declaration to mean that all men were created equal in all respects. Certainly the Negro is not our equal in color." And by the way, just as an aside, at that time he also would have said he's not our equal in that he should hold public office or serve on juries or a whole bunch of other things, because at that time Lincoln either personally didn't believe it or politically felt he couldn't say that. So in those respects, no, there is not equality. But he says, certainly, he's not equal in various respects, but still in the right to put into his mouth the bread that his own hands have earned. He is the equal of every other man, white or black. And so I would argue really rather early in Lincoln's development of his thought that even though he wouldn't grant Negroes equal status in everything at that time, he changed after that, he felt that they had the right to earn their own money and keep their own money. And this is interesting, too, because you have to realize that in the South there were some 4 million slaves, and if you realize how much money they added to the economy for which they were never paid, it's in the tens of billions of dollars, the tens of billions of dollars that these people labored for and never got the benefit of. And that disturbed Lincoln very much. And again, that's part of his whole idea of he was entitled to go ahead and work and improve his condition. Why couldn't Negroes work hard and improve this their condition? But no matter how hard they worked, they were still slaves. So certainly when it came to labor, this was something that, again, is part of the American dream. Work hard, get ahead. Another part of his idea, and I'm going to have to move along here, is education. And he believed, again, from his own experience, he was self-educated, that people should be not only allowed to educate themselves, but they should be helped, that it was up to the society to see that people could have a good education. And he says that, I have to share this with you, I think it's so wonderful. He talks about free labor and what free labor thinks, which is really what he thinks. "As the author of man makes every individual with one head and one pair of hands, it was probably intended that heads and hands should cooperate as friends, and that that particular head should direct and control that particular pair of hands. As each man has one mouth to be fed and one pair of hands to furnish food, it was probably intended that that particular pair of hands should feed that particular mouth, that each head is the natural guardian, director, and protector of the hands and mouth inseparably connected with it, and that being so, every head should be cultivated and improved by whatever will add to its capacity for performing its charge. In one word, free labor insists on universal education." So, you know, we still use the term hired hands. Well, I mean, he didn't think that somebody should just be somebody else's hands, and then someone else could be his head, like a head of state. So it's, I think, really very interesting. And then he sees around him, remember, most of the people around him were farmers, and he says how education is in every field of labor, and he talks about how it enhances agriculture. He says, "Every blade of grass is a study, and to produce two where there was but one is both profit and pleasure." And he talks about how education lightens and sweetens toil, and that where there is education, there will be no community can ever be the victim of oppression in any of its forms. Such a community will be alike independent of crowned kings, money kings, and land kings. So to him, education was part of being independent, being able to make your own way without having to ask permission from anyone else. And then finally, I want to just spend another couple of minutes on what is the role of government in all of this. I mean, so far we've looked at the individual has a right to reinvent himself, whatever his ethnic background. The individual has a right to advance himself economically through hard work, whatever his color. And by the way, it is always his, because Lincoln didn't talk too much about the rights of women, although it seems clear that he believed if they pay taxes, they should be able to enjoy the benefits of society. And then about education, how if you have an education, you can make profit, you can have fun, you can be independent. Well, does government have any role in all of this? And yes, it does. It has a very important role. I'll just take 2 seconds to give you a bit of historical background. In the 1830s, there was a party formed in the United States called the Whig Party. And the Whig Party believed that the federal government should help build the infrastructure of the country. It was known then as internal improvements, should maintain high tariffs to help protect industry, and should have a national bank to help stabilize the currency and for investment. And Lincoln was a Whig, and the Republican Party, which was formed in 1854, was really the successor to the Whigs, except that it added to this idea these ideas of a strong federal government to help economically, that it should prevent the expansion of slavery. So the Republican Party was the old Whig Party with the important addition of no expansion of slavery. And Lincoln, as a Republican, believed in a strong federal government. He believed that it was the government that should help level the playing field so that the individual within that could advance himself. And I'm going to read to you a speech that he gave before Congress on July 4th in 1861. So the Civil War started just a few months before that. And I think this is kind of the capstone of how he sees what happiness means in the Declaration of Independence. It's about why the Union is fighting. I think as we look at the Civil War, we can understand why the South fought, because the war was in the South. There were battles in Maryland, which was part of the Union, and there was Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. But other than that, all the other battles were in the South. And so it's easy to see why they would fight just to protect their homes and so forth. But why would Union soldiers fight? What was in it for them? Why didn't they just say, okay, let it go? So Lincoln is, again, redefining, reinterpreting, giving definition to what the struggle is really about. And I guess one of the qualities of Lincoln that is so extraordinary is, and I get this idea, by the way, from James McPherson, he mentions this in his book, The Second American Revolution, is his ability to look into a situation and get at what it's really about. So this is what he says in 1861. "This is essentially a people's contest. On the side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Yielding to partial and temporary departures from necessity, this is the leading object of the government for whose existence we contend." So in one paragraph, I think it just says it all. So just to reiterate, and then we'll do the talk back, his reinterpretation of the Declaration of Independence emphasized economic mobility, equal opportunity, opportunities, I would say, for enlarging the middle class. And he saw not only the individual as very important in this, but also the government as well.